Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Our guest today, back by popular demand, at least my popular demand, is Dr. Andrei Korobkov, professor, now full professor of political science, having been promoted, and world traveler extraordinaire. He has just spent time in conferences under the auspices of two different international institutions, delivering messages about the brain drain of intellectuals from Russia and talking with academics and politicians from various countries. Most notably, he was able to speak for 2 hours with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev in the Kremlin about ways to lure intellectuals back to Russia to help stimulate its economy and its academic vitality. And Andrei is going to talk to us about that today and also about the very issue that this entails, because it's It does have importance for the United States, as well as the issue he discussed in Germany, which has national security implications. So, Andrei, welcome. And do you want to start with Germany, which came first in chronological order, or Russia, which comes first in prestige order?
It was really an interesting combination, because I was invited to Berlin by a NATO think tank, and after that was invited to Russia to the conference that was sponsored by the Russian government. So first we talked about security issues in Central Asia, in Berlin, and these are some very serious issues. First of all, there is a spread of fundamentalism from Afghanistan to the countries of the region, and they're very apprehensive about that. Second, Afghanistan supplies about 90% of heroin to Europe, and increasingly this flow that initially was directed through Pakistan is now being redirected through Central Asia and then via Russia to Europe again. So the United States is very apprehensive about it. Central Asian governments are very apprehensive, and the Russian government is becoming very irritated with this issue. So this is a situation in which basically our interests coincide, and there is a desire to do something about it.
And these countries include some former Soviet republics, including Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan,
all
Tajikistan.
Five stands, so
all five.
Stan means basically home of Kazakhs and so on. So Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan. All Muslim countries, four Sunni, one, all five are Sunni, but four are, Turkish-based cultures, and one is Persian-related, Tajikistan.
And it's not only their geographical positioning that makes them of strategic interest, but also their wealth in natural resources.
Oh, yeah. Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan have tremendous mineral wealth. And usually people the only thing they know about Kazakhstan usually is that, Borat was about Kazakhstan or from Kazakhstan. But in reality, Kazakhstan is the seventh largest country in the world. It's giant. And it possesses practically all resources available in the world, with one exception. Ironically, they don't have only one resource, or, don't have it in adequate amount, and it is water. And vice versa, two countries neighboring on this region are very poor but possess huge water resources. These are Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. And this is becoming a very touchy issue, because tensions grow in regard to water supply, and it might be a very explosive issue by the middle of the 21st century.
Not to mention the fact that the governments of these countries lean toward an authoritarian bent.
Yeah, to put it mildly, yeah.
Yeah.
In addition, these are countries with huge surplus population, all of them with the exception of Kazakhstan. And millions of their residents, their citizens, have moved to Russia, many illegally, Now they are also moving to Kazakhstan. And Russia finds itself, ironically, in the same position as the United States in regard to Mexico. It receives millions of migrants, labor migrants, many of whom are illegal. So the U.S. has about 12 million illegal migrants, while Russians have about probably 4 to 5 million. And these people are different ethnically, culturally, religiously. They are dominantly Muslim. And therefore, tensions grow within the Russian society, and there are such phenomena as xenophobia, and unfortunately, many politicians in Russia also are trying to play this ethnic card now.
You have done extensive research in migration among the former Soviet republics from now country to country, and the resulting ethnic and culture clashes that have created turmoil in these nations to varying degrees depending upon the area you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. And the problem is that you practically cannot stop this migration. Well, for example, the gap between the United States and Mexico in terms of per capita GDP is now about 4.5 times. Well, at its highest level, it was about 8 times. But the gap between Russia and the poorest of the post-Soviet states, Tajikistan, that we have mentioned already, is 18 times. So it is much wider than the one for the United States and Mexico. And then under these conditions, use various measures, but you essentially cannot stop the flood of migrants, including the illegal ones.
This meeting in Germany took place October 27th through the 30th in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, and it was sponsored by the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies. The participants included members of parliaments, committee chairs, representatives of international organizations, academics, representatives of the European Union. But you told me earlier that the politicians and the academics seem to think that inviting these nations to join the European Union and or NATO at this time to give them some semblance of cover or sense of unity would not be a very good idea.
Yeah, it was clearly indicated that the expansion of NATO, first of all, into the post-Soviet zone right now is being put on hold. First of all, because of the Georgian, Russian war 2 years ago that has shown the danger of escalation. We shouldn't forget that Article 5 of the NATO Charter clearly states that attack against any member of NATO would be considered an attack against every member. So if any country of NATO goes to war, we automatically find ourselves at war with their opponent. And because these are regions that are not very stable and not very democratic, and to put it mildly, NATO started to look with suspicion at the further expansion, at least at this time.
How much potential does this Central Asian region have to become as much of a hornet's nest as the Middle East has become?
Well, it is to a very large extent, unfortunately. And there are some issues that are even more painful in Central Asia. First of all, it borders on Afghanistan. Simultaneously, it borders on Iran. Simultaneously, it borders on Russia and China, and while possessing huge resources, it is totally landlocked, and therefore there is no good option. There, you can transport resources through Pakistan, through Iran, not very kind of happy options, through Russia, that is much safer but creates political dependence, or through China, and China is eager to invest, eager to basically consume any resources available. And this also makes us kind of apprehensive, because it is a resource base that is totally independent, outside our control, if the Chinese, for example, introduce their control over the region. In addition, China has its own Muslim area, the so-called Xinjiang Uyghur region, that borders on Kazakhstan. More than that, Uyghurs essentially are ethnic Kazakhs. Many of them have moved to Kazakhstan, many have stayed. but well, it only has created further links among the countries of the region. And unfortunately, we also see the emergence of a number of opposition movements, many of which, for example, the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, have acquired fundamentalist character and actively, by the way, participate in the war in Afghanistan. We have both captured and killed members of this movement in the territory of Afghanistan.
Would we, or should we, be fearful of a full-scale military option being exercised by China in this region at this time?
No. No, the Chinese vice versa. They avoid any kind of confrontation, and their interest at this point is economic. But we should be apprehensive about them exercising at some point total economic control over the region if we do not show our effective presence there.
BBC Radio several months ago did a series on water worldwide, and although it was objectively done, and I think very well done, the overarching theme of it was that the next great war, if one is to be fought, might be fought over water, not over oil. And you did mention that parts of this region, some of these countries, are starved for water. What options would they have, and with what countries would they do business to get their water, or what countries might be interested in making some sort of Faustian political bargain for them in exchange for access to water?
Well, first of all, it is unfortunately not a new phenomenon. Well, even the Iraq invasion of Kuwait in 1990 was not only about oil, but also about water. But in that region, it is becoming a real political problem. The region is the site of the largest environmental disaster in the world right now, even though it's not mentioned frequently. If you look at the map of the region, you would see a huge salty lake that is called Aral Sea. It does not exist in reality. It lost more than half of its water, and right now consists of two salty, dirty swamps. There are numerous birth defects in the regions surrounding this lake. And the reason for it happening is, the unlimited, politically motivated irrigation of the Soviet period. There are two rivers that start in Afghanistan, flow through neighboring Tajikistan, and then, get to Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. Sirdarya and Amudarya. Most of their water has been used for irrigation purposes to produce cotton in Uzbekistan. Not only it resulted in the loss of water in the Aral Sea, but it also has resulted in tremendous negative impact on the land. It became salty in Uzbekistan. And right now, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, again, these are among the poorest countries in the world. They have an ability to regulate their water supply. And Uzbekistan, first of all, and other countries as well, are very angry with them because Uzbekistan needs water, but Tajiks and Kyrgyz, they need energy. And they can produce this energy through the use of hydropower of those rivers. But any use of this hydropower results in cutting the water supply to the lower regions in Uzbekistan.
And all these years hence, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, these countries have still not done away with the Soviet model for water usage.
And not only that, you're absolutely right here, but they haven't done with the Soviet political model. They renamed their parties, instead of communists, they're called national parties, and something like that. But essentially, they have retained one-party systems. And many of the leaders of the region are former Communist Party first secretaries. In Kazakhstan and in Uzbekistan, the same people sit in presidential seats that were ruling them under those regions under the communist regime.
Okay. Now we move on to the fun and glamorous part, the glass-clinking part at the Kremlin, but also very serious issues being discussed. You were at the 4th Annual Assembly of the Russian World Foundation, November 2nd through the 4th, in Moscow. This is a foundation that is President Medvedev's baby. Yeah. It is very much something that he is concerned about. What is the purpose of this foundation?
Well, there is general purpose and there is personal purpose. The general purpose is to rebuild ties to the Russian diaspora, first of all, elite diaspora abroad. About a million people have left Russia after the dissolution of the USSR in 1991. About 2 million people have emigrated from the Soviet Union during the Brezhnev and consequent years. They have children, grandchildren already, some of them. And, this is a highly educated diaspora. Russia has lost, hundreds of thousands of highly skilled academics. And for a long time, people like me were perceived as, if not traitors, but at least negatively. Medvedev is changing this orientation. He says we need to work with these elites. We need either to lure them back or find other options of working with them. And, this is the first idea. Second is to spread, Russian culture and language throughout the world. This is nothing unusual. We have your United States Information Agency, the French, the British have similar institutions. Germans have Goethe Institute and so on. But Russians never paid attention to this aspect of foreign policy, the so-called soft power. Now they are trying to rebuild the bridges. As I said, that was the first kind of general idea. Second is Medvedev's personal interest, because there is a struggle going on between his group and Putin's group for influence, and they are trying to offer more appealing models of foreign policy, of internal policy, and this is one of the brands that Medvedev is kind of promoting.
And part of the problem, or part of the issue, speaking of reluctance to get rid of Soviet models or Soviet ways of thinking, is that while academic freedom is paramount to every professor in charge of a classroom or a research project in an American or Western developed nation university, the Russian intellectual who might be lured back to his home country will find more government intervention than he would in the United States, Great Britain, Canada, whatever. And that irks academics no end, to have someone tinker with their freedom to explore ideas and new directions.
Absolutely. That's the main problem, and that's what, unfortunately, most Russian political operators do not want to understand. And even the models that are offered now, they don't really take this aspect into account. The only kind of positive side to it is that they are primarily interested in people in sciences, in basic sciences. Because 3/4 of academics who have left Russia first have left 3 major academic centers, Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Novosibirsk. Second, the same 3/4 fall into 4 academic categories. These are chemists, mathematicians, physicists, and biologists. So these are primarily people, again, in basic sciences, less interested in kind of ideological issues. There is a tremendous weakness of social science in Russia in general, and underrepresentation of social scientists among Russian elites abroad. Just about 6% of people who, academics who work abroad are representing social sciences. And only 15% of PhD degrees that were received by Russians in the United States in the last 15 years were, again, people in social sciences and humanities.
Plus, Medvedev also has a little pet project to the north of Moscow, you told me, that is sort of a Russian Silicon Valley, in which he's very invested in it, and he's trying to attract monetary investors and intellectuals to work on it.
Yes, this is promoted as the Russian Silicon Valley, exactly, but they're trying to build a separate, relatively isolated town with very good environmental conditions. That's important in Moscow because it has a horrible environmental situation. People who would work there would have special taxation, legal regime, so they don't. The idea is to protect them from all the niceties of the Russian bureaucratic system. Hard to say how effective would it be, first, second, who would come, because you really need to offer very serious compensation for people like me having tenure in order for them to move.
Tenure represents job security, and professors are loath to give that up unless the extraordinary compensation is offered.
Yes, sure. In Russia, the problem is that, say, it is Medvedev's project. Next year, he can change his mind, or there might be a change in government, and the new leader would say, you know what, I didn't give you any promises, and that will be it. And people, of course, keep that in mind. But it's still an interesting attempt to do something, because Russia finds itself in a, one can say, ridiculous situation. Just 13% of its exports are, manufactured goods. Practically all, and most of these, quite frankly, are, weapons. And the remaining are metals, gas, oil, some other resources. So Russia has an export structure of a low-developed country, even though it makes huge, money, amounts of money on exporting these resources. But, this is an export structure of a highly undeveloped country. Second issue is, Russians still account for about 10 to 12 percent of the world academic personnel. It's a huge number. But they produce less than 1% of the world high-tech exports. The United States generates more than 36% of the world high-tech exports. And therefore, the gap is just shocking. And Medvedev looked at it and said, look, we have such a tremendous potential. We need to try to activate it. Even if we just lure in Russian hackers, it already would be useful. And we'll give them legitimate jobs, promise to pay them well. They can produce something interesting, useful, and quite legitimate.
So you delivered a presentation, the main presentation at this conference, where the Russian brain drain was being discussed. And how did you and President Medvedev get together?
I was giving this introductory presentation about half an hour, and after that, people who represented various high-tech businesses and academics, Russian academics living abroad, were discussing it. And the chair of the panel two chairs. One was Professor Sadovnichi, who is president of Moscow State University, the most elite school in Russia. And the second chair was the head of the Russian world, Vyacheslav Nikonov. Nikonov is an interesting person on his own. He is what Russians call political technologist. So he is advisor to, kind of shadow advisor to the president, and works on his electoral campaigns, on his political programs, sometimes writes his speeches and so on. But his second interesting feature is that he is grandson of Vyacheslav Molotov. And even people who haven't dealt with Russian foreign policy or politics probably have heard about Molotov cocktail that you usually don't drink.
That was the Finns called it a Molotov cocktail. Molotov himself is not responsible for that.
Molotov
phrase.
Himself, as a matter of fact, I asked Nikonov and he said, my grandfather never could figure out where it come from. Nikonov said, listen, all this is very interesting, and this is what the president is interested in. So let's arrange it the way that at the state reception on November 4th, we put you next to the president so that he can chat with you about it. We sat next to each other and spent most of the dinner talking about both, brain drain and some other issues, including U.S.-Russian relations. And then he said that he wanted to finish this conversation, so we went out and continued it for another, well, half an hour.
What was your impression of him on a personal level?
Well, he's a guy who likes having power, well, and is not shy to show it, so he interrupts you and, well, just shows that he is a boss. What's positive is that he is well-educated, he belongs to a new, younger generation even compared to me, so he is interested in modern technology and likes to show that he understands this technology. So in this sense, it was interesting. But it's also clear that, well, he likes to be the boss and to show that he is the boss.
So it's not exactly like two friendly academics jawboning and having a counterpoint and shooting back and
no,
forth.
No, no. Well, if he suspects that you disagree with him, he gets irritated, and he was asking me kind of sharply, so what, you disagree with me, even though I might not have been disagreeing with him, but still, well, I'm an outsider, so for me it was more funny, but I think working for him is not that much of a joy.
And your impression of Nikonov, personally?
Nikonov is very smart, and, well, he is a classical political operator, so he is pretty cynical, but again, it's fun to talk to him because he knows a lot, he understands a lot, and he knows a lot about Russian history, such things that still are not published even now, and on a personal level.
He's savvy and calculating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about the glamorous part of the evening, the entertainment aspect of it.
Well, when you come to the Grand Kremlin Palace, and it's usually the part that is not shown to the outsiders, it's impressive. It's been renovated. Its walls are covered with gold, so it's just shocking. They recreated the Tsar's throne room with three thrones, and so it's a giant room. Well, and it's mostly gold and malachite, Russian semi-precious stone that also is used there to cover walls. There are columns made of malachite. The dinner itself, state reception, probably about 500 people were invited, so some celebrities, some state officials, foreign guests like me. So Medvedev came, he gave a short speech, then he awarded state medals, and then we continued with dinner. And sitting at the presidential table were Marie Mathieu, a famous French singer who was awarded with a state honor, the patriarch, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Evgeny Velikhov, who is vice president of the Russian Academy of Sciences in charge of nuclear program, two kind of celebrity TV anchors, Russian, so their names would not tell people anything here. Me and one more academic, a mathematician from Switzerland.
Do you expect that enough barriers will fall to make Medvedev's aspirations of attracting Russian intellectuals back to the homeland a reality?
I hope so. And in general, from what I've heard, Medvedev's perception of the problem is the correct one. He says, I understand that you cannot just try to lure everybody in, and you cannot count, well, full professor and a graduate student as one-to-one. Well, you have to differentiate your approach and try to find, new, more flexible ways of working with the academic diaspora. In this sense, his approach seems to be more flexible than Putin's. The question is, which approach would win?
So the rivalry between Medvedev and former president, now Prime Minister Putin, continues.
Yes.
And whether this grand idea wins, we'll just have to see how the power struggle develops.
Yeah, and in Russia you never know because, everything goes behind the curtains. So even if you're in the Kremlin, you still cannot figure out what's really going on.
You're not going to give us any odds on this one.
Well, the only thing that I can say, and it was kind of surprising to me, that a number of the general perception always was that Putin is totally in charge and basically other people around him are puppets, including the president.
But that was what everyone said when Medvedev first assumed the position of president.
And, even now, many people are saying that. But what's interesting, there is a couple of highly positioned political operators, like Nikonov, by the way, and also there is another one, Gleb Pavlovsky, who obviously put their eggs in Medvedev's basket. I have no idea whether, they are doing a correct thing, but usually these are very well-informed people. So anyway, it is clear that there are some tensions within this, dual relationship, diarchy, and something is cooking there. Very hard to say what exactly.
Yeah, perhaps Medvedev will save the Russian intellectual and Putin will save the Russian tiger and we'll just let each of them go to their separate spheres, but I wouldn't take any bets on that either. Dr. Andrei Korobkov, Professor of Political Science, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.